Well, good afternoon and assalamu alaikum. And before I begin, I'd just like to say that it's a great honor and it's a very humbling experience to be among such luminaries and among such great speakers. And I applaud the organizers of the conference. I'm sure it must have been a great jihad to organize this conference. Also, what type of jihad I'm not going to talk about in this particular lecture. The topic at hand is about the reception of Ibn Taymiyyah's fatwa on ruling by other than God's law amongst modern Salafi scholars. One of the theological cornerstones of many, if not all, modern jihadist movements is the claim that the rulers of Muslim lands are apostates, they're kafirs or murtads, who must be fought. They base this claim of apostasy on the theological premise that anybody who judges by other than God's law, the Arabic phrase, al-hukum bighayri ma anzalallah, is a kafir or a disbeliever. And while the primary reference that they have for this is a verse in the Quran, which is Surah 5, verse 44, وَمَنْ لَمْ يَحْكُمِ مَا أَنزَلَ اللَّهُ فَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْكَافِرُونَ. Whoever does not judge by God's law is a kafir. They also invoke a historical precedent, and that is a fatwa that Taqiyuddin Ahmad ibn Abdul Halim, also known as Ibn Taymiyyah, died 1328, wrote against the Mongols. And this fatwa has already been referenced by a number of speakers before me. In this paper, I will summarize the contents of this fatwa. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about the fatwa itself because it's already been studied by Thomas Raff in 1973, by Denise Eigel in a recent article in 2007, and then move on to a discussion of how various modern Salafi authors and theologians have understood it. The fatwa of Ibn Taymiyyah itself. One of the most politically significant fatwas that Ibn Taymiyyah ever gave was his famous fatwa that legalized an all-out jihad against the Mongols, or to be more precise, the Ilkhanate kingdom of the Mongols. The ruler of the Ilkhans, Mahmud Ghazan, who ruled from 1295 to 1304, had unsuccessfully attempted to occupy Syria three times. And in each of those three times, Ibn Taymiyyah played a visible role. The first of these occurred in 1299, the second in 1300, and the final and most decisive was in the spring of 1303, in which the Mongols suffered a resounding defeat in the Battle of Marj al-Suffar. What made this particular jihad, which otherwise would have seemed pretty simple, so complicated, was the fact that Mahmud Ghazan had converted to Islam. And this conversion took place in June of 1295. Now, since the Ilkhans and Mahmud did not previously have a binding oath of allegiance to the caliphate, the Mamluk caliphate, technically they couldn't actually be considered rebels because they weren't rebelling against any oath that they had, nor were they usurpers. In fact, immediately after converting to Islam, Ghazan, Mahmud Ghazan, adopted the title Padishahi Islam, or the King of Islam, and made religious claims of establishing authority and leadership over the entire Muslim world. And this was very clear in his aman, or his declaration of peace that he gave in 1300 to the people of Damascus. Therefore, the question arose as to why Muslims should fight on the side of the Mamluks against the Mongols, especially because many Muslims weren't terribly satisfied with the Mamluks, their status quo, their ignoble origins, their taxation policies, etc., etc. Why should we fight siding with the Mamluks against the Mongols? Additionally, many amongst the Mamluk infantry appeared to break ranks and change sides. And the question arose, by changing sides, were they merely mercenaries fighting for the highest bidder, or could it be claimed that they were being treacherous to Islam itself? There was also the rather strange phenomenon of certain segments of the Mamluk army showing, at a rather opportune timing, one must add, pacifist tendencies, and becoming conscientious objectors on the argument that the Mongols were fellow Muslims and they were not allowed to fight fellow Muslims. And of course, there was the added factor of the ethnic similarities between many of the Mamluk soldiers, some of whom were enslaved from lands bordering the Mongolia, and of course, the Mongols themselves. And a final factor that really makes the point very clear is if the Mamluks should fight the Mongols, why should they fight them? What is the religious basis for fighting? Are the Mongols to be fought like usurpers? Are they to be fought like highway robbers, qutta' al-tariq? Are they to be fought as apostates? Are they to be fought a defensive jihad or an offensive jihad? All of these questions were taking place in the background of this fatwa. And so it was in the context of this confusion that Ibn Taymiyyah took the lead. and championed the claim that the Mongols had to be fought. It was wajib and fard ain, he said. It is binding on every single capable Muslim to fight a no-holds-barred, full-fledged, offensive and defensive jihad against the Mongols. And the fatwa, in fact, occurs in a number of different treatises. And in the modern collection of Ibn Taymiyyah's fatwa, we find three different treatises written against the Mongols. The first of them is clearly dated, 1299. The second and the third are not dated, but for reasons beyond the scope of this paper, it seems clear that the second of these three is the last, and it is also the most comprehensive. So we shall be relying on the second one to the exclusion of the other two. Ibn Kathir, the historian, mentions that it was probably in 1303 when this fatwa was released, when he says that there was a heated discussion amongst the inhabitants of Damascus regarding the impending invasion of the Mongols and what should be done. Ibn Taymiyyah says it was at this point that the fatwa of Ibn Taymiyyah was given. So we assume that it is the same fatwa that is being referenced here. The fatwa begins with a question, a very long question, it's actually a page and a half long, posed to Ibn Taymiyyah, in which the questioner seeks to know the ruling on the Tatars, or the Mongols, who have continued to invade Syria time and time again. The questioner says they claim to be Muslim. So their matter, he says, has become confusing to most of the people. Should they be fought? And then he says, and if so, on what basis? Ibn Taymiyyah responds, and he says, in order to give a fatwa on this matter, two separate issues need to be discussed and clarified. The first, what is the status of the Mongols? And the second, what is the ruling and judgment of God upon such people who occupy that status? And he begins with the second point instead of the first. And he says that every single group that claims allegiance to Islam and yet refuses to abide in totality by the laws of God must be fought. And he finds precedent in early Islam. He says, just like the first caliph Abu Bakr fought against those people who refused to pay zakat, and just like the fourth caliph Ali ibn Abi Talib fought against the Kharijites who seceded from both Muawiyah and Ali's camp, he said, this is the type of fighting that must be done against the Mongols. He differentiates this fighting from the fighting that occurred between Ali and Muawiyah, which he calls the civil war or the fitna. He said, the fighting that occurred between the companions was a different type of fighting. They didn't take prisoners of war. They didn't run after a fleeing enemy. Their tactics were far more humane versus their fighting and their jihad against the Khawarij, in which they did take prisoners of war, they did take booty, they did distribute war booty. He said all of this is the way that jihad should be done against the Mongols. With respect to the state of the Mongols, what allows Ibn Taymiyyah to say that the Mongols are like the Kharijites or like those who did not pay the zakat in the time of Abu Bakr? Ibn Taymiyyah says, I know them very well. I have conversed with them, he says. And of course, he's referring to his visits, at least two, perhaps three times he visited Ghazan directly and interacted with him. He said, I have been to their camps. Most of them don't pray. The adhan or the call to prayer is rarely heard. They don't even go for the pilgrimage. They fight for the sake of the Mongolian kingdom and not for the sake of God. And then here is where it gets crucial, he says, and they place Genghis Khan in a status above even that of the Prophet. For they follow the laws that Genghis Khan has formulated based upon his whims and desires. By doing so, Ibn Taymiyyah says, they do not conform to the judgment of God, hukmullah, but rather use their own customs. He writes, and I quote, and it is known by necessity in the religion of the Muslims and by agreement of all Muslims that whoever follows a law other than the law of Muhammad is a kafir, is a disbeliever. And it is just like the disbelief of somebody who believes in one part of the book and rejects other parts of the book. End quote. So he basically saying that the Mongols pick and choose elements of the religion to suit their convenience and give a false show of adherence to it. And he says quite explicitly, if the people at the time of Abu Bakr should have been fought because they only gave up the zakat, how about the Mongols when they've given up the entire system of Islam? He says the case is even more clear. He also says, just like a person who becomes a Muslim and then leaves the religion, an apostate, is worse than a person who's a non-Muslim in the first place. In other words, he's saying the murtad is worse than the kafir asli. He says that just like the murtad is worse than the kafir asli, he says the Mongols are worse than actual non-Muslims because they pretend to be Muslims, they claim to be Muslim, and yet they do not actually do Islam or submit to the law. So he actually makes the case that the Mongols are a category even below that of non-Muslims because they claim to be Muslims and yet they are not. So we can summarize Ibn Taymiyyah's fatwa before proceeding on by stating that Ibn Taymiyyah clearly drew analogies between the people who refused to pay zakat and the Kharijites in early Islam and between the modern Mongols. Based upon his understanding, just like the Kharijites did not fully conform to the Sharia, just like the people who didn't give zakat rejected one principle, similarly the Mongols have done the exact same thing and should be fought because they are outside the fold of Islam. That is Ibn Taymiyyah's fatwa. To discuss its reception, I have chosen a number of authors and theologians from a number of different centuries. We'll discuss two theologians post-Ibn Taymiyyah, two theologians pre-modern era of our times, and four or five, depending on how much time permits, of our era. That's quite a lot, so please bear with me. We don't have much time. Okay, we'll try to do this very fast. The two theologians post-Ibn Taymiyyah are Ibn Kathir and Ibn al-Qayyim. Both Ibn Kathir and Ibn al-Qayyim seem to understand very clearly that anybody who judges by other than the law of God is a kafir, no questions asked. They have no conditions, they have no reservations, and we don't have time for the quotes, but it is quite clear that they understood Ibn Taymiyyah's fatwa at face value. In the pre-modern era, the two people that I want to look at are the Egyptian scholar of hadith Ahmed Shakir, who died 1958, and the Saudi scholar Muhammad ibn Ibrahim al-Sheikh, who died 1969. Again, we're looking at the Salafi movement, so I'm not going to look at Maududi and Qutb and their understandings. That's not quite the topic of the paper at hand. Both Ahmed Shakir and Muhammad ibn Ibrahim al-Sheikh, once again, are very explicit in this regard. They both claim that anybody who judges by other than God's law is not a Muslim, no questions asked. Ahmed Shakir, in fact, says there should be no confusion about such a person, and if there's any ambiguity, he even says, for example, the laws that are now being imported into Egypt, that are now being enforced upon most of the Muslim lands, he said there should be no doubt that anybody who judges by these laws is simply not a Muslim. Similarly, Muhammad ibn Ibrahim al-Sheikh, who was the first Grand Mufti of Saudi Arabia and the one who occupied the post before Ibn Baz, he also wrote a book which is called Tahkim al-Qawaneen, or Judging by Man-Made Laws. And he basically says that the worst type of judgment that can possibly be done is to make a composition between Sharia and man-made laws, choosing bits from the Sharia and bits from American, British, and French law. And he says, and I quote, "What greater kufr is there than this kufr?" So it's quite clear that even pre-modern era, the understanding of Ibn Taymiyyah's fatwa has been pretty consistent. What is very interesting is that when we move to the modern era, all of a sudden a shift seems to take place. And this is the thrust of the topic, and I have how many minutes left? 5 minutes?
No, two, three.
Two, three, okay. We'll try to do this. The thrust of the paper is about modern Salafi scholars, and it is quite strange and interesting to note that amongst modern Salafi scholars, all of a sudden this classical understanding seems to have been completely disoriented. There are three scholars that are considered to be the leaders of the modern Salafi movement. All three of them have passed away in our times. The first of them is Abdul Aziz ibn Abdullah ibn Baz, who died in 1999, the Grand Mufti of Saudi Arabia. The second is Muhammad ibn Salih al-Uthaymeen, who died 2000. And the third is Muhammad Nasruddin al-Albani, a Syrian-trained Albanian origin scholar of hadith who died in 1999. All three of these scholars held differing positions amongst themselves, none of which fully agreed with what I would call the classical understanding of Ibn Taymiyyah's fatwa. And just on a personal note, this was a very huge controversy that erupted in the late 90s amongst the Salafi movement. And I remember in my old undergraduate days in Medina, this was the hottest topic of the time, where the students would always be debating amongst themselves because these scholars were still living and their students would go and pose questions and get responses, and they'd be spread on cassette. And it was indeed a very tumultuous time for the Salafi movement of the 90s. So the first of these is Ibn Baz's position. Ibn Baz clearly disagreed with his own teacher, Muhammad ibn Ibrahim, when he said that judging by other than God's law does not make you a kafir. The action is not an action of kufr, he said, unless it is accompanied by a state of the heart in which such laws are deemed to be permissible. The Arabic is istihlal. If you consider it permissible to judge by other than God's law, then you are a kafir. But the mere act doesn't make you a kafir. And then he adds, how will you ever know the inner thoughts of a ruler. Therefore, we really cannot pronounce takfir on the rulers because we don't know their inner thoughts. And when he was asked, your own teacher disagreed with you, he said, my teacher was but a human, no matter how great he was. The evidence is in the Quran and the Sunnah. And he interpreted Ibn Taymiyyah's fatwa to mean that the Mongols are kafirs because they considered it permissible and not because they actually did the deed. The second cleric on our list, Muhammad ibn Salih al-Uthaymeen, he held a position that can best be described as a cautious modification of the classical position. Al-Uthaymeen did say that al-hukm bighayri ma anzalallah is kufr. However, he was very hesitant to say this most of the time. He never wrote a book on it. Many times people approached him and asked him questions. Most of the time he would rebuff the question. And he said, this topic should not be discussed in public. This topic should not be answered amongst the masses. However, I have recordings of his which are more private and available to his closer students, where he's asked this question, and he says, yes, judging by other than God's law is kufr, even if the person doesn't make istihlal, doesn't consider it permissible. However, he then adds, and he always does this, I've never heard a recording where he doesn't add this point, where he says, however, a person who doesn't understand the importance of God's law might be excused for his ignorance. In other words, he's using a maxim called al-udhr bil-jahl. If you don't know, you're excused. And he keeps on stressing that rulers of our times generally don't know their religion. And in one cassette that I heard, he actually said, the rulers of our times cannot be called kafir because they don't know the status of Islam and Islamic law. So the bluntness of Ibn Taymiyyah's fatwa is kind of mitigated by Ibn Uthaymeen. The final of the three is Muhammad Nasiruddin al-Albani, who definitely had the most mild, if you like, understanding. Actually, he outright rejected this understanding, and he said that in all situations and scenarios, judging by other than God's law is never kufr. In and of itself, it cannot be kufr. And he actually disagreed with the understanding of Ibn Taymiyyah and others in this regard. Before I conclude, very quickly, two other scholars we have to mention, Safar al-Hawali and Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi. Okay. Okay, so I'll conclude with this then. Al-Maqdisi's. Al-Maqdisi, of course, is, I would say, the one actually representing the classical understanding of Ibn Taymiyyah's fatwa, quite blunt about it. He says modern democracies are nothing but the Mongol nation resurrected in our times. To conclude, it appears that the literal understanding of Ibn Taymiyyah's fatwa throughout the centuries occurred when there were no current equivalents of the Mongols. In modern times, most, if not all, of the Salafi scholars have been forced to modify their understanding of Ibn Taymiyyah's fatwa. If indeed ruling by other than the law of God is major kufr that expels one from Islam, what exactly does that do to the religious status of all modern political states? It is clear that the very real problem of declaring most Muslims to be non-Muslims, at least those involved in the political arena of Islam, has led the major theologians of the Salafi movement to reassess and reanalyze the fatwa of Ibn Taymiyyah. Thank you very much, and my apologies for going over time.